Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We are coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Marlene Even. We're heading across the ditch this week to chat about New Zealand journalism. How do their journalism practices differ from Australia's, and what can Australian media learn from our Kiwi neighbours? We'll be taking a look at another major media report this week, titled Worlds of Journalism Study 2.0, Journalists in Aotearoa New Zealand. The study uncovers who New Zealand journalists are and what they think of journalism. To discuss all this and more, we are joined by Carmen Parahi Potiaki Matua of Stuff. Welcome to Fourth Estate.
Oh, tēnā koe, Marlene. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk with you and James today.
And we are also joined by Associate Professor Dr. James Hollings. James is a researcher at Massey University in New Zealand, and he is the lead researcher of the New Zealand Worlds of Journalism Study 2.0 report. James, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Tēnā koe, Marlene, and tēnā koe, Carmen. Lovely to be here.
So let's jump straight in. James, how does New Zealand journalism differ from Australian journalism?
Well, we've been studying journalists in Australia and New Zealand now for about the past 10 years or so in the Worlds of Journalism study. We've just completed our latest New Zealand version of the study. Australia's is still to complete theirs, but we can talk about what is like, say, around about 2015, 2016, the differences there. And I don't think a huge amount would have changed. And what you see is they both come very much from that sort of Anglo-Western tradition of journalism, which is that news journalism should be sort of relatively fair and balanced and not biased. And the sort of traditional roles of journalism are being, you know, observers of society, reporters on society rather than activists for political change and so on. But within that, there's a few quite interesting little differences that go on between Australia and New Zealand. So Australian journalists, we can say, are more interested in the what we call the consumer-orientated roles of being a journalist. So, for example, if we ask them questions like, do you think the role of a journalist is to provide entertainment and relaxation, Australian journalists will say, will give a higher rating, a high proportion of yeses to that question than New Zealand journalists. If we ask them, do you think your job is to provide the kind of news that attracts the largest audience, Australian journalists would give you a higher rating to that question than New Zealand journalists. I mean, so for example, Australian journalists would respond 3.7 out of 5 for that one. New Zealand journalists would respond 3.3 roughly. So quite a big difference, maybe 20% difference between Australians and New Zealand journalists on that, what's called the consumer-oriented role of being a journalist. In other words, they're there to sort of serve the audience. And so on the other hand, if you ask them questions like what are called the classic sort of watchdog questions, you know, is your job to monitor and scrutinise political leaders, Australian journalists and New Zealand journalists are very similar. Both think it's very important. So if you want to sort of sum all that up and say, what's the difference? Well, Australian journalists are a little bit more, I guess, in the classic traditional role, West Anglo-Western role of being a journalist, of being neutral observers, meeting the consumer needs of the audience, if you want to put it that way. Whereas New Zealand journalists are a little bit more interested in slightly more partisan, well, not partisan, but the more what they call mobiliser role of, you know, helping change, if you like, and getting involved in advocating for social change. Not much so, but just slightly more, that's all. So that's sort of some of the key differences I would see.
That's really interesting. And Carmen, for you, you've been to Australia for reporting trips. On the ground, how do you see the two countries' journalism differ?
I also worked for Whakaata Māori, Māori Television, which means we had a relationship with NITV and SBS because of that. So we're able to interact with NITV in Australia as well as work with Indigenous communities there on stories. So which was great for us and great for me to be able to do that, to Just as we're comparing what journalists do here in Australia to Aotearoa, it's also interesting to see how journalists in Australia and officials and officialdom and government actually respond to Australian Aboriginal people as well. So so being able to do that means I can actually look at mainstream media here, Māori media here, look at our Indigenous media in Australia, as well as compare it to mainstream. And it's all anecdotal though, so I'm hoping James, as part of this report, may actually look at whether we take a check on Indigenous media as well, in both countries and other Western countries where colonisation, colonialism has happened, because it'd be interesting to see what the ratings and the differences would be, what the similarities are in the journalism amongst Indigenous journalists compared to other Indigenous journalists in other countries, and also to see how Indigenous journalists view their own media within their own countries and with regards to Indigenous matters, right? So my experience has been very anecdotal because obviously we don't have a lot of those studies available, but the experience in New Zealand has been, or in Aotearoa, has been, as James alluded to earlier, the news media, it's a Western European construct. It is very Eurocentric in its traditions and it's the way it views and lenses the world. So if you're looking at Indigenous issues through a European, Western, Eurocentric lens, it means that you will marginalise the experiences and voices of communities like Indigenous peoples, because they're outside and they'll be in seen in the margins of that Eurocentric lens. So I don't think the experiences are very different. I know, speaking with other journalists over the years, Indigenous journalists over the years from Australia, their experiences are very similar to ours. But I feel like Australia's is more extreme. At least here we've been using Te Reo Māori for a long time in the media. So in Māori media, particularly Māori language media, and mainstream, there are words and phrases that have been used over time. That is actually ramping up a lot now, which means that there's more and more expectation within the industry to use more Te Reo Māori. You will hear it on the radio, you will hear it on television, and you will see it on stuff.co.nz, which is where I work, and you will see translated stories in Te Reo Māori. So we're one of the only media in New Zealand that actually publishes Te Reo Māori stories online. And it's, to be fair, just to make a distinction here, so there is a common Te Reo Māori language, and so there are dialectal differences between tribes, which we haven't started going into as a nation to make that seen and heard, but you do see that on iwi or Māori tribal radio stations, you hear dialectal differences. So I do know in Australia there are varied differences in the different languages that are spoken in Australia. So what has helped us is to have a common Te Reo Māori language so that we can all use that for everybody in Aotearoa. So everyone in Aotearoa is encouraged to use and speak Te Reo Māori. So quite a few similarities and experience as an Indigenous journalist, being involved in a mainstream media newsroom as an Indigenous journalist, very similar. You will hear stories of racism, anecdotal evidence of racism within the newsrooms. A discomfort, being challenged every day because you have your own cultural views and experiences, and your voice as an Indigenous person being shut down as well. So those are things that we have been talking with our counterparts in Australia and sharing information and stories for a long time now, as we try to ask our media in New Zealand to do better for Māori. At the same time, I would challenge Australian media to do better for their people as well, because from where I sit, I do view the Australian media as being quite racist, a lacking of any recognition of their own behaviours towards Indigenous people through that very singular Eurocentric lens. You've got a few exceptions like SBS and ABC, but even there we have spoken with journalists who have felt very uncomfortable, and over time they became the only brown voice in a very white institution. And that's a really hard thing for people to have to shoulder on their own. So they burn out and leave early. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, both sides of the Tasman. But, you know, we keep moving forward. So there is progress, consistent progress. But there is a long, long way to go. I would love to see ABC particularly, or one of the big papers, The Australian, perhaps, actually reckon with their past, their history, investigate it to find out whether they have, how they have treated their Indigenous population in the way that they've reported on them, and just reckon with that and reconcile with that and try to find ways to make amends into the future and build better relationships.
And last week on our program, we looked at the diversity or lack of it in Australian TV and news and current affairs. James, what's the situation in New Zealand on New Zealand media across the board?
Well, just from our most recent survey, I can tell you that ethnicity. So,
it's
if we look at the newsrooms and New Zealand journalists, about 2/3 of New Zealand journalists are New Zealand European, about 10% are Maori, and 7% are European, you know, genuinely European, from born in Europe, and about 3% Asian, about 2% Pacifica. There's been a reasonably good increase in the number of Maori in New Zealand newsroom in the last 6 or 7 years. It's gone up about 20% from about 8% to about 10%. Still quite low when you consider the number of Maori in the general population, which is around 15 to 20%. So still got quite a little bit of work to do there to get a sort of more representative proportion. Pacifica is still very low, and Asian is still low. Those are the sort of big areas. There's a growth in the New Zealand Asian Indian population in New Zealand and in journalism in New Zealand. We're seeing that growing quite quickly as well. That's the general sort of overview.
In those numbers as well, Marlene, as James said, it's disproportionate to the working population and disproportionate again to the general population. Some of the Indian community are actually doing their own media, which will probably push up those numbers. But we're way underrepresented. We've got so, and this is what it kind of makes me feel agitated, actually, and I get very impatient. Not around you, James, or the study, but just I get impatient because we know this, and these studies are great that James and other academics do, because it paints a picture, a stark picture of the reality of it. So when you have that many Pākehā who are in news organisations, it does create bias towards that group and their population, and so that's what's really important, to ensure that you have a proportionate amount of journalists compared to the population, but also from an equity perspective, you should actually expect to have more. So New Zealand and Australia are both in the Pacific, right? We have huge Pacific numbers in our populations that have an influence on society. We're right next to Southeast Asia. We've got Southeast Asia across to up to India, representation in both our countries, and yet their voices are marginalized, stereotyped within those organizations where they are not the main news organization. So there is a lot of work to do there. Let's not forget we need to also improve our disabilities representation, our queer representation. That needs to be seen in our newsrooms as well, because if we were to So the role of journalists is to observe and, but also to educate and influence society. How can you do that when you actually don't even look like society? Like, you physically do not look like society. So how can we say we deliver for everyone when we don't? We deliver for everyone through a particular lens. And that is, that's until we like really acknowledge that in Australia, particularly, like New Zealand's gone through a huge reckoning in the last two and a half years, particularly. So we're becoming more and more aware and acutely aware of what work we need to do. But Australia is so far behind. They really need to sort their shit out.
Mm-hmm. Can I just give a quick example? I totally agree, Carmen. Can I give a quick example, actually, for your listeners of why diversity is important? And this is a story which is goes against the usual narrative of Australia, New Zealanders are better than Australians and all this sort of thing. There's a town in New Zealand called Pokokoe, which is just south of Auckland. And it was the centre of a kind of whites-only policy in New Zealand for a long time. It had a colour bar. It was basically apartheid. And that sort of story has been unearthed recently by an American academic who's been here.
And not so long ago either, James.
That's
right. So it wasn't like it was in the 30s, 1930s. It was right up into the 70s.
Yeah, in the 1960s, if you were Māori in Pukekohe, you couldn't get your hair cut at the local barber. You had to go and you couldn't sit upstairs at the cinema. You could only visit the swimming pool on Friday, that sort of thing. And so, interestingly, Pukekohe, this American academic, has gone into Pukekohe and they've tried to reckon with this terribly racist sort of past. And they had a sort of a healing hikoi, which is a Māori word meaning march through the centre of the town street. This is quite recently, in the last few weeks. And the local paper, the Franklin District Times, didn't cover it because they don't want to hear about it, you know. And so, on the other hand, if there was some Māori working at the Franklin District Times, presumably they would have covered it. So that's how it plays out. That's why diversity is important, because otherwise stories just get ignored.
I do have to say, though, I do have, and I've said this to James before, concerns around the use of the word diversity and inclusion, because it always comes from a reference point of we're the majority.
Yes.
So we're the majority and we want to help create diversity and we want to be inclusive. Whereas if you're coming from my perspective, I'm like, well, there are variations of all types of people that are in New Zealand. So it is not about diversity. It's not about inclusion. It's about social cohesion, which is actually a term I prefer. Is how do we create social cohesion in our newsrooms? How do we create social cohesion in the public? And is it even the role of journalists? I'm not sure it is. I am a bit old school, and I do like being an observing journalist. But at the same time, without things like Tamata Puno, which was our investigation of our own organisation to reckon with our history and past, and then apologise to Māori for it just 2 years ago. If we'd had an observer role, we would never have done that work. So there is also a shift in our journalism ethics around observation and getting involved in education, because what is interesting about James's study is that seeing journalists say, well, actually, I'm here to educate the public as well, I thought that was fascinating, because it is a shift away from the observer role, because there's more of an understanding around every journalist brings their own bias to the newsroom, whatever they may be. I prefer dark chocolate to light chocolate. I prefer the Hurricanes rugby team to the Blues rugby team. So there's all these sorts of quirks and bias that belong to everybody. So I think we are learning more and more about being an observer, being independent, but knowing at the same time, actually, I have my own biases and I'm going to bring it here to my news reporting. So I think we're getting to that place where we're in this tension at the moment about redefining journalism and what it's going to be in the future. It's actually really exciting, but in that tension comes conflict and concern. And it can be quite polarizing, even in newsrooms, about how a story should be covered and why a particular story was covered in a particular way. So there, I do think it's exciting. I really, really like James's study. It tells us a lot, and we push hard at stuff to ensure that our reporters were a part of this as well. And I was interested to see that actually there is a very centre-left politics or thinking, not so much politics, but attitudes in those that actually responded to the study as well.
And it's so fascinating to really have a look at what the role of a journalist is and to compare like traditional roles and, as you mentioned, Carmen, like this idea of being the observer, and when you step in to either educate or to advocate, or for the example of the apology that you mentioned. But James, when we're talking about what the role of a journalist is and what the journalists in New Zealand believe the role of a journalist is, has there been a shift from this idea of the neutral observer to the idea of educating audiences?
Yeah, a small but subtle and really quite significant shift. So as Carmen was saying, what she was talking about with what's going on at Stuff there and the work that she's done is incredibly interesting in the way it's challenged the organisation to, and for those of you readers in Australia don't know, Stuff is our probably mainstream number one online news organisation, or dominates. It used to be owned by Fairfax Australia, and now it's taken over in local ownership, thank God. And
I agree.
And so it's done this amazing reckoning with its past, but it would be like News Corp almost doing a sort of a deep dive and reckoning and changing and saying, look, we've been racist, and we'll be like, so it's that kind of level of engagement throughout New Zealand that Stuff has. And so, you know, these are often very traditional trained journalists that work for Stuff, and they've been doing this reckoning as part of this organisation, and they're very on board with it. I mean, the figures show in our survey that journalists believe this is important to do. And so huge credit to Carmen and her team for leading that and sort of realising that the moment had come to do that. And it doesn't have to compromise the role of a journalist of being an independent observer. But anyway, back to your original question, Marlene, there has been overall in New Zealand journalism a significant sort of interesting shift. If we ask them what the two top roles of a journalist are now, they would say it's combating disinformation and educating the audience, whereas previously it was, you know, the basic observer role. And that's a really interesting shift that's going on. It's part of the widespread concern that's out there about the disinformation disorder, as it's called, sort of thing that's going on.
I think disinformation, actually, I was really pleased to see that was one of the top two, actually, James, because it is, for me, I think it's an opportunity for journalism to really prove itself now, because we're having to push back and really take on our role as the for the state and take on that watchdog role to help society understand the difference between disinformation and what is reliable sourced information. And actually the danger of disinformation, which we saw in Stuff Circuit's documentary Fire and Fury, how disinformation is really working hard to undermine democracy and all things that our society has developed on over time. So those are disinformation is a big one. And I don't know what the figures are for the Australian media. James would know, but I would suspect that Australia is very aware of this as well. And I would hope that is up in its top considerations around journalism.
Yes, I agree, Carmen. Yeah.
One of the other points in World of Journalism study report is that in the top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fifth one, which wasn't asked in 2015, but it was asked in this one, which is to speak on behalf of the marginalised. Now, we did talk about this in a discussion with James and other academics, media academics, around what that meant, because to speak on behalf of the marginalised, you would have to be careful around that, but the fact that it was there and it was quite high up, I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, it is interesting, isn't it? And I think journalists are sort of challenging some of the old roles, and there's this new generation coming through that aren't just happy with being the sort of, I think one of those interesting, other interesting shifts is they aren't just happy with being, I guess, meeting consumer needs and, you know, telling their readers which tool they should buy at Bunnings this week to, you know, to put the spring planting in with. They're also interested in doing other stuff as well. And they see, I think, that there is this kind of almost a war going on with the information disorder people, the, you know, challenging the fake news people. And that what is that is a direct challenge to sort of journalists' role is in terms of giving audiences factual, reliable information.
Yeah, I'll just touch on that point around speak on behalf of the marginalised again, because what I was thinking about was that actually what happens is like at the COVID 1 p.m. stand-ups that we used to have with the government and health authorities, is that often reporters would ask questions, but on behalf of the all of society questions. Whereas now we have been asking our journalists, please ask questions for Māori, please ask questions for Pacifica, because their experiences through COVID are totally different from the general population, totally different from Pākehā New Zealand or White New Zealand. So I think that's what they mean by speak on behalf of the marginalised, is that actually when we're in front of the authorities, when we're in front of people with power and control, we actually need to speak up on behalf of all parts, different parts of society, so that they get to hear the answers they need and we can actually write the stories in response and for them. So the other week we had the Reserve Bank governor talking to us about inflation, about enforced rise in inflation, and that may actually enforce a recession next year. So he's telling us, don't spend so much, spend less. But not a single reporter asked Adrian Orr about whether the Reserve Bank had considered how their policy would actually impact on people in low socioeconomic communities. How would those policies impact on Māori? How would your policies, Mr. Adrian Orr, impact on our Pacifica community? Because they all have different experiences when it comes to a recession. And when the economy starts to fail, it is those communities that will struggle the most. And not a single one of our reporters actually asked those questions, which is very concerning, because we're still using that monocultural, I will ask my questions for all New Zealanders, and it's very generic and there's no specificity in those answers. So we, like I said, we've got a long way to go, but when you have people that are consistently advocating to speak on behalf of the marginalised, that is what they mean, is that they will ask the questions on behalf of Pacifica communities to say, yo, Minister, what are you doing for the Pacific community in your policy?
And it's such an important point. Carmen, looking over to Australia, the media coverage is increasing here on the Voice to Parliament, which is a proposed referendum to constitutionally enshrine an advisory group to the government made up of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders. What do you think are some lessons the Australian media could take from New Zealand media and the reckoning that you've been talking about?
There's got to be multiple actions. So there is no one fix. There needs to be multiple actions to shift the culture and the way of thinking around the media, right? So if the media views that work and what's happening through the wrong lens, they could start to report on it quite differently to if they were to report on it from the lens of Indigenous peoples in Australia. So it's really important that you actually think about what lens you're putting on when looking at particular subjects. So you can look at one subject and put totally, like, just change the lens over and over and over again, and you get different outcomes every time. You also get a different story, and you'd use different voices as well. So this is the beauty of using a multi-lens approach to journalism rather than the single Eurocentric lens, because you get to have an enriched view and enriched voices and way better storytelling if you apply a multi-lens approach to journalism. So, and you can still remain the observer, you can still remain you know, a journalist who is independent, that is not swayed by politics or can't be bought for the stories that they're doing, right? So those are really important things that no one should ever, ever get into.
So just add one little point, observation. One thing that I don't know if Australians are aware, but we've had it in the last sort of 10, 15 years or so, Māori television in New Zealand, which has been incredibly successful. So the government intervened, set up a separate funding stream for a Māori television channel, and that's grown and grown and grown and been a huge influence in New Zealand in sourcing Māori content, developing Māori content, hearing the language te reo spoken constantly on air with subtitles, so anyone can get involved, anyone can learn. It's a great way for everyone to sort of participate and involved in, and hugely successful, I would think, in New Zealand. It's been, I don't think you wouldn't hear anyone who says that they should be got rid of or anything, or that it's separatist or any of that sort of rubbish. It's actually just a, really has grown the whole media scape in New Zealand. So that's been super, super influential. And it's also had a great, just give you one quick anecdote about a former student of mine working in Māori TV. And this is why I think a TV, a channel like that, why it's so important for the overall benefit of all New Zealanders, is she was telling me about a story she did about a police shooting of a young Māori guy in Taranaki. And long story short, she got a great story with the family that they would never have told to Pākehā media, because she knew how to talk to them and she knew how to access that story and get inside what really happened in that police shooting, because she was Māori, but also because she knew how to speak to that family. And that's a benefit to all New Zealanders, that that kind of watchdog role that she could play, because she was coming from within that Māori, tau Māori, Māori world. So we've come a long way in New Zealand in some ways, but I mean, one of the truly great success stories we have had is Māori TV.
But when it was first set up, and when it was first mooted, there was actually a Aotearoa Television, James, that was set up before Māori Television, and it was really political, highly political, very challenging, and people complained that it was separatist then. And then Māori Television was set up. But at the time that it was being set up, people did complain. So you had politicians that would complain, called it separatist, we didn't need it, it was a waste of government money, but it was still set up. And it remains there, and it's still doing its work and creating good content, as James said. But it wasn't without its controversy. There were people that did say that it was an expensive waste of time. But of course, it's proven itself over and over again. And Māori Television, actually, or Whakaata Māori, it's called now. Whakaata Māori is a very strong relationship with NITV in Australia.
It's been wonderful to learn about the differences between New Zealand and Australian journalism, and also quite a few of the similarities as well. Thank you both so much for joining the program.
Thank you, Marlene.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Marlene. Thanks, James.
Thank you, Kamu. Ka kite.
Mihi mahana ki a koutou. Hei kuna.
Ka kuna.
And thank you for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. And to hear more about the media reckonings and the Stuff.co New Zealand apology, we have a special podcast series that Carmen joined us earlier in the year for. It's called Black Bias. It's hosted by Rhianna Patrick and Madeline Heyman-Reba, a collaboration between Indigenous X, the University of Technology Sydney, and 2SER Radio. Head on over to Fourth Estate Podcast and you'll find the 6-part Black Bias podcast series. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to our executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Marlene Even. Thanks for listening.